Welcome to Consider This Program. I'm your host, Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you guys all along. Well, I'm going to start with the bad stuff first. And not the bad. I just don't want us ever to forget. You know, Wednesday was the mark of September 11th, which I'm finding there are more and more people who have chosen to forget or who weren't born, who are already adults, aren't darn near. It's hard for me to imagine you can be 18 and not know, you know, what 9/11 really was. But it's one of my best friend's birthdays, and I was at that point in time doing live radio every morning, and I had friends in those towers. So tough day for the entire country and a tough day for us, but let us not forget. On the fun note, unless you happen to be a Colts fan, and a Patriots not fan. On a sad note, the Colts did not come out on the top on week one of the game. And I got back to the office on Monday to hear all of the conversations over fantasy football, surprising draft picks. So I know as a business owner that fantasy football builds culture and camaraderie and all that other good stuff, but it also costs the government productivity, GDP. So I sent Angie out on a little bit of research. So tell us about fantasy football in the next 60 seconds here, Angie. How much does it cost me?
Over the next 5 years, a 13.24% compound annual growth rate in terms of revenue will occur in the next 5 years. Because right now, it's a $7 billion industry.
Fantasy football. So they're expecting it to grow by more than 10% a year is what it's saying, effectively compounding. So in economics, we talk about an S-curve and the escalation of new people coming on every year or paying more money for it. And from what I can tell, there are plenty of people who are emailing you guys wanting to offer their professional success for a little bit of kickback or money, right? So you're going to pay Ken Dilger a little bit of money. Ken's going to tell you who ought to be in your lineup, and you're going to take advantage.
I can do that.
You're going to take advantage of your unknowing friends. That's where that growth rate is coming from.
I have been dying to know from you. What, from a former professional player, what do you think of fantasy football? Do you guys hate it?
You know, as a player, I think from like 95 to 2004 when I was playing, it was just getting going, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was.
Any
internet
times.
Wasn't as capable as
right.
it was today.
Well, 95 was
we are
the
old,
first time
Ken.
Of internet and, you know, and email addresses, I guess. But as a player, you really don't think about it. Maybe it's changed now since it's been such a big deal. But I remember in 2001, a long time ago, I threw a touchdown from Peyton Manning threw it to me. I threw it to Marvin Harrison.
I was there.
So then I go to Tampa Bay at the end of the season. I'm in the hotel lobby, and one of the guys comes up to me and says, "Hey, Ken, I won my fantasy football because you threw that touchdown to Marvin Harrison." So, you know, you get stories like that, which you think is pretty cool. But, yeah, I play it with a couple of guys.
And you think it doesn't matter, and Ken's still talking about it 18 years later. Hey, you're listening to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, your host, along with Ken Dilger and Angie Kinzer. Hey, if you want to do this on your own, that's your business. If you're looking for a fiduciary, that's our business. Give Angie a call, 800-928-4001. We'll take a break and be right back.
Hi, Joni Michaels here. We know you care about your money, but are you tired of worrying about it? The Financial Enhancement Group takes care of people just like you who don't want to worry about their money. As fiduciaries, the team at the Financial Enhancement Group will care for your nest egg just like they would care for their own if they were in your situation. There are many decisions you'll need to make as you face retirement, and the team at the Financial Enhancement Group is here to help you. Call 800-928-4001 or go to yourlifeafterwork.com to set up a time to meet. The confusion and complexity of retirement is almost as daunting as is the excitement of retirement. Don't let your fear and frustration of taxes and investing derail your retirement. Call the Financial Enhancement Group at 800-928-4001. They'll give you a complimentary second opinion on your strategy for retirement. Begin your adventure in your life after work. Call 800-928-4001 or yourlifeafterwork.com. Now back to Consider This Program with Joe Clark.
There are few things more frustrating than when things don't go as planned, especially when you think you had a plan. Hi, I'm Joe Clark, your host.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Welcome to Consider This Program. We've got a special today. About once a quarter, we focus on one topic as in-depthly as we possibly can. And at the Financial Enhancement Group, we look at what we call five critical elements that we think have the greatest ability to disrupt or drive home the retirement that you really want to have in your life. And in order, this is how we deal with them every year. The first is what we call your life after work, because not everybody retires and just watches grass grow. Most people find something to do, whether it's for profit or not for profit. The second is the annual tax planning, making sure that you understand there are two tax codes, one for the informed and one for the uninformed. The third is the investment playbook, which we have to deal with pretty much on a weekly basis in terms of what's going on in the economy and the market. Fourth is life happens, the good, the bad, and ugly of life. And the fifth one that we're going to talk about today is really this legacy planning. And people think it's the, you know, what happens when I die? There's really a whole lot more to it than that. But it's how you transfer your values and the things that are of value, your accounts, your investments, how do you transfer them in the best way to the next generation, knowing that different beneficiaries exist differently? And so I'm going to start off by explaining what one of the things, and there's multiple stories that got me here. I think there was a plan in my life from the time I started. But I remember when my grandfather passed away, my grandmother moved a double-wide mobile home on my uncle's property. My grandmother told me that she had a will, and that in the will, everything went to my father and to my uncle. And I walked by. Grandma, when you buy a double-wide, by the way, you have a title, not a deed like you do to a house. And if you're from out of state, a double wide essentially means a mobile home. And I walked by and I saw the title. And the title had my grandma's name and my uncle's name on it as joint owners. And I said something to Granny. And I said, you know, you said you wanted everything to have to go to Dad and have to go to Uncle Tommy. And she said, that's right. And I said, well, the double wide, which is pretty much all of the money they had in the world, that's not going to happen. And because you have this title. And I remember Granny looking at me, Angie, and she said, Joey, the last person alive allowed to call me that, Joey, it's in the will. And Ken, before I met you, I had a will that gave my mom the Eiffel Tower, my dad the Cubs, and my brother the Bears. And I did it to try to prove a point. It doesn't matter what's in a will. If you don't own it, you can't give it away. And the bottom line is, with the way that title was structured, nothing would ever make it that asset never made it to the will. It didn't matter what the will said. You can't give away something that you don't own. In the world of trust, that's called funding. And so some of the questions that Angie were getting was here, and we kind of coordinate them over the course of a quarter. And if you want to add your questions, just email her, consider this at yourlifeafterwork.com, or call her at 800-928-4001. We're happy to add your question. But here's the deal. The question number one, Angie, I believe is...
how do I know if I need a trust?
Good question. And it really comes down to this. In the old days, Ken, people would say you needed a trust if you had a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an attorney. Don't play one on TV or radio or as a columnist. I guess I do all three of those things. But in my mind, when I made the decision personally to have a trust, it had absolutely nothing to do with whether or not I had the amount of money that I had. It's other things that come into mind. Privacy is a big one for some people. You know, the ability to keep my information from people being able to see it. If you have a will, Ken, and you pass away, I have the ability to go to the courthouse to figure out what you owned and who you left it to. Right? Some people aren't so happy about that idea.
Right.
You may remember that a gentleman named Mr. Irsay had 54 attorneys on staff, according to a newspaper article in Indianapolis, 54 attorneys, and died with a will. And we almost lost the Colts because estate planning was not done. Nobody expects to die on any given day. Someday in the future, I promise I'll die. You know, God promises that for us. But tomorrow, probably not. Right. So you just don't get around to it. But part of it's privacy. Part of it is the control. I want to be able to control how assets are distributed upon my demise. That's a reason to have a trust. I want to avoid a thing called probate. It doesn't happen as much anymore, but people walk into the office, Ken, and they'll tell me that I won't go through probate because I have a will. Well, understand, if you have a will, the only way that functions is that you go through probate. Now, people will ask me, Big Joe, don't you have a will? And the answer is yes, I have a will. It's called a pour-over will, not P-O-O-R, P-O-U-R. And what that means is a pour-over will, anything that I forgot to put in my trust, please do. Okay?
And can a will be used for things, smaller things like, say, heirlooms, like a certain pin or something that you wanted to go to your daughter?
It could, but what if I had a $500,000 heirloom? Do I want the world to know that my daughter, who maybe doesn't live in a house with ADT, you know, who's not on the bed, just got, or, you know, we've got a shotgun that the original Joe and John Clark, two of our great-great uncles, you know, found in one of the early wars in the Spanish-American War. Do I really want them to know where that went? Right? In a trust, it's private. In a will, it's public. Right? So inside of the trust, a lot of those things are dealt with. But yes, you can do that. I prefer not to. Right? Next question.
The next question is, what are the advantages? I mean, there are two different kinds as far as you hear revocable and irrevocable. And we've been asked before, what in the world is the difference between those?
Well, you can actually use the words. Revocable means you can change it. I can revoke it. I can change my mind. So what was that? When we were kids, you could put your left leg in. Oh, the hokey pokey, right? That's one of the ways that I treat a trust. A grantor trust is what Barb and I have. So a grantor trust is stuff that we freely put into the trust, right? So we own the trust and we gave a gift to the trust. Totally tax-free, totally something that is not a tax liability at all. And it's like the hokey pokey. I can put my left leg in, I can put my left leg out, I can shake it all around. You know, we used to do that roller skate at what was it called? Muncie Riggins?
Well,
that,
I don't know.
That was a long, long time ago. Anyhow, we're talking 7th and 8th grade, so you know, just a few decades. But regardless, you can pull money, put stuff in, and pull stuff out of the trust. It's not a taxable event. That's revocable.
Okay.
Irrevocable occurs when an event occurs. Typically, those two events are when I die, or when I become physically or mentally incapacitated, and then my other trustee or successor trustees take over. And they are taxed differently, by the way. An irrevocable trust has its own tax ID.
Well, yeah, because on the surface of us, when you say it's irrevocable, you can't change it. I always wondered, why would someone want that? Why would you want it to where it's permanent?
Because I want somebody to be able to take care of me when I can't take care of me. And I don't want them to be able to change what I wanted to have happen. So we're dealing this right now with somebody who had in 2000, their attorney created a trust, inappropriately assigned the IRA. They passed away, the IRA beneficiary, inappropriately done, right? Guy died. My family inherits the IRA, and there's nothing that we can do to fix it because it came from an irrevocable trust. An attorney ran it. It's just part of the deal. So we're actually going to have two conversations on this, and then a third from Ann Snyder. We're going to have a conversation over how some of this looks. Hey, you're listening to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, your host, along with Ken Dilger and Angie Kinzer. Hey, if you want to do this on your own, that's your business. If you're looking for a fiduciary, that's our business. Welcome to Consider This Program. I'm your host, Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you both along. You know, we're talking about trust and I'm going to say special issues. One of those is special needs. We're going to have a guest on this week named Ann Snyder. She's an attorney out of Indianapolis that we do a lot of work with. And we're going to talk about some of those special quote unquote needs trust that need to get out there, that need to be able to be addressed. And I will tell you that this is one of those things where many times can people think they can go see an attorney and have a trust done or a will done.
Right.
And it's kind of like a check mark. Right. I mean, we're able to check off when we wake up in the morning, you know, yes, I listened to the motivational tape, or yes, I did my workout, or check this off or check this off. Your legacy planning is not a checkoff thing. It's kind of like a relationship. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, the issues that Barb and I have after 31 years of marriage change, you know, with our kids changing, our parents changing at their ages, you know, those kind of things move around all of the time. And you really have to stay abreast of your legacy planning from a couple different aspects. Your current income taxation, your future taxation. We know everything about the tax code today is going to sunset December 31st of 2025. So some people have to make some serious choices between now and then. And believe me, 2025 may sound like a long way away. I bet you're still listening to this show. All right. I mean, things change. The time just flies. But the tax code today, the tax code in time, the future, your assets, how your beneficiaries are, marriages, deaths, divorces, kids being born. There's so many things, and it's an ongoing relationship that we just have to pay attention to. So let's keep going. We've had some trust questions called in. Angie, go ahead and fire away.
This one has to do with a charitable trust.
Okay.
And the question is, how can a charitable trust be used as a planning tool?
Oh, lots of different ways. A charitable trust, they're, most of them are designed so that I make a charitable gift today. It's usually when you have an appreciated asset. You would rarely do this with cash. I suppose it could happen, but rarely with cash. But let's say I bought a building for $100,000 and now it's worth $1 million. And I don't need the money and I'm charitably inclined. I could gift the building to a charitable trust, sell the trust or sell the building inside of the trust, and the trustees would have to do that. I can't be the trustee of the charitable trust, right? The trustees would choose to sell the building. The trust doesn't pay any taxes, and I get a gift of fair market value for the building less, and this is important, less my life expectancy factor that's coming from the IRS. So if I'm 90 and I make a gift of the building to a charitable trust, the IRS presumes that I'm going to die sooner and I would get a larger charitable gift. If, on the other hand, I am, 52, which I happen to be, and I made the gift of the building today, the IRS would knock down the amount of charitable deduction that I could have right now. A lot of different ways to use charitable trust, especially for people who have very high incomes who don't live high on the hog, right? So if you're a neurosurgeon making $1 million or $2 million a year and you're going to retire and suddenly go to living on $150,000 a year, your tax bracket's going to change. You can use a charitable trust or a donor advised fund as a way to fund future charitable contributions at a higher tax rate and get a bigger benefit for it. A lot of different ways to go there.
Okay, this one is about a constructive trust. This was interesting to me because the question is, can the courts set up a trust for you if they believe that you had intended for something to happen?
Courts can do about anything. The problem when you read articles like that, we've got a certified financial planner that's on the team as well as myself that's in Bozeman, Montana. And she focuses on marital disputes. So you're going through a divorce, she helps separate assets. And so when she found out in Indiana that we didn't have alimony, she thought I was nuts. In fact, she said, "You're wrong." She's wrong. and she rightly apologized for it. Different state laws are different across the country. People moved to Indiana, much to my dismay, to get divorced. Because there was no such thing as alimony in Indiana. There's a settlement of the value at the time of the divorce. I was just baffled, Sarah. Kind of put her out of work in Indiana. So she's, stuck with the other 49 states. The court can, and it happens a lot when you have kids who inherit money. You get an 18-year-old and it inherits a fortune. Courts can do that. But it depends on the state that you're in. But it can be done, especially if they think it's in your best interest.
Well, speaking of kids, is there a specific trust that's best tax-wise as far as leaving assets to your children once both of you are gone?
What you want to do is to leave it inside of a trust where the income is distributed. Once you have an irrevocable trust. So again, an irrevocable trust occurs when I'm incapacitated mentally or physically or if I die. Right. Then the rules can't change. The trustees step in. My successor trustees step in and they have to follow the game plan, so to speak. A trust is taxed at the highest marginal tax rate. So right now it's a little bit above 37% on income once you cross $12,600. So it's a very minimal amount of income is taxed at that rate. So you want to make sure inside of your trust that the income itself is distributed. And there's very special things. This is why it's important to have an estate planning attorney as opposed to somebody who says, yes, I can write a trust. There's very specific language that says whether a capital gain is treated as income or not, right? And again, different states and the way that they have to be set up. But you want to make sure that the income is distributed so that it's not taxed at the trust rates, again, unless you have a special needs issue. And Ken, this kind of comes to your kind of life because I'm sure you have sat down with somebody who wants to buy a house and says, but Ken, I've got all of this assets over here.
Right.
And then you have to prove to your mortgage lenders that they have the capacity to pull income out of there more than what they're pulling.
Well, we have come across that situation when somebody gets divorced, doesn't have a job, but they get a huge financial portfolio.
Windfall. Right.
And what you can do is you can set up a irrevocable trust. I'm sorry, a revocable trust, I think,
mm-hmm.
put that money in there and have the trustee write a letter, or your financial planner write a letter saying, hey, he's guaranteed 10 grand a month for 5 years.
I don't even have to write that it's guaranteed. I just have to put in a letter that says I have the capacity to spend this, you know, so that you know that you're covered.
So we can do it like that too.
But the other one is, let's say something happened to me and Barb, right? And the money went to Kaylee and Kendra's trust, because this is a more realistic one. Forget the divorce. We don't believe in divorces. No, just kidding. I mean, hopefully we never have to deal with that, but it happens, right? So in that particular case, there is a clause inside of the trust that says my three wise men, those are my successor trustees, the three wise men have the ability to accelerate distributions if they so choose to take care of certain things. A house is one of those things that's specifically listed.
Correct.
Right? They don't get to buy your house. They don't get to buy my house, but they can buy a house. I mean, right? So, you know, the three wise men have the ability to distribute that. And what I have seen happen, and sometimes because they're irrevocable trust, is mortgage companies say, no, you can't, unless the money is distributed, we're not going to count on them distributing the monthly payment, you know, because they could shut it off. I think that's an absolute mistake and lack of understanding of the way world works.
Well, Fannie and Freddie says, I think you only have to have two or three distributions before you actually get it. Then after that, once you get the mortgage, you can do whatever you want to.
Exactly. And the other part is, even if you're going to distribute it out of the house, you can have them take the money for the house so that it's out of the trust and put it into another account and remind them that if they don't play nicely, the more money probably will be less likely to arrive at a particular time. Hey, you're listening to Consider This Program. If you want to do this yourself, if you want to be your own fiduciary, God bless. That's your call. If you're looking for a fiduciary, that's our business. Give us a call. Talk to Angie. Get a time to come in. 800-928-4001. We'll take a break and be right back. How in the world can you have a negative interest rate? Really? People pay me money to deposit money inside of a bank? Oh, no, wait. That's me paying them to hold a negative. You've got to be kidding. Hey, welcome to Consider This Program. I'm your host, Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you along. Hey, in all sincerity, negative rates are across the globe. They're just not here at home yet. And it is a crazy world, the things people don't think of, Ken.
Of course.
Before you and I met, when negative rates first occurred, back in the 08 and 09 era, when people wrote mortgages in Europe, Spain specifically in this case, they never thought about negative interest rates. And so I don't know how your paper works. Ken's in the mortgage industry. I don't know if your paper is attached to LIBOR or if it's attached to Prime, or if you got a combination of the two that you're able to use.
Yeah, I don't know how they set the rates. You know, most of the commercial loans out there are either based off of LIBOR or a prime rate, but...
So LIBOR, if you haven't heard of it, that's the London Intraday Banking Offering Rate. And a cute little word for a larger mechanism than just the prime rate that we use here in the United States. But what happened is nobody thought about negative rates. And so Ken goes and borrows €1 million. That's the currency that they use in Spain. Borrows €1 million to buy a house, buy a villa in Spain. Sounds good, right? And it's a variable rate, which means it changed based on LIBOR. Well, suddenly their rates became negative in Spain. That means instead of you having a $1 million mortgage inside of Spain and you making a payment of interest every year, instead your principal was actually being reduced every month because the bank owed you money because you had a loan. Angie, why don't you go ahead and break this down for us? Why don't you explain what a negative rate is?
I'll ask the questions.
So let me tell you this. Every week, either Adam Harder, our chief investment strategist and CFA, that's here as part of the firm, one of my partners, either he or myself do a video called The Market Carver. It's a free thing that you can get if you go to our website at yourlifeafterwork.com. And we send you out a video every week, every Thursday, that says, hey, this is what we believe happened in the economy that was major last week. 2 or 3 weeks ago, we actually did a piece on negative rates to try to help people explain it. So get signed up for The Market Carver. Like I said, it's free. But here's the example that we used. That people don't understand currency, Angie. That's really the problem. And so it's kind of like when people take Social Security and they're thinking about just Social Security. That's called thinking in a silo. or when people can think about negative rates and they're only thinking about a negative interest rate. How is that possible? What you have to do is to put everything in the complex of an entire farm operation, not just a silo, but the barn, the house, the grain, the pigs, the cows, the whole bit, right? You've got to bring everything in together to be able to make a decision. And what we were able to show at that point in time, the German 10-year Bund was trading at a negative 0.88%, right? But if you were able to do a currency hedge, you could actually incur a 1.9% annual return for 10 years by buying the negative rate because of a currency spread that existed between the euro and the US dollar. Now, I know that's complex, not expecting you to understand it, just trying to let you understand why somebody would buy a negative rate instrument. A lot of reasons. I went through about 5 points on the Market Carver that week. So get signed up. Go ahead, Ange.
Well, the article that I had read did mention Denmark as far as having the mortgages with negative rates.
That's because I'm old and I was well awake and alive in 08 and 09. I don't just talk about it. I lived through it. Try managing your in-laws' money during the greatest recession our lifetimes.
It was
Thanksgiving was great. It was beautiful. It was just a special time in my life. No, they're great people. I'm very, very blessed to have them and the families that we took of. We were actually able to grow through the 08 and 09 crisis, but it certainly was not a lot of fun.
Okay, so we hear a lot about Japan, Germany, France. And it actually, in one of the articles, it said Germany just sold the first negative yielding 30-year bond.
They did. We call it you can call it a bond complex or but the whole point is you have short term, 30-day, 1 year, 2 year, 10 year, and 30-year types of bonds. And they actually sold some at a negative rate. So what that means is people were expecting to receive less money in the future than they were in the past. Again, going back to the Market Carver, one of the things people forget, Ken, is if you're obligated to buy, right, Germany still runs about a 2-3% surplus in their annual GDP, where we're running a negative, right? They run a positive, right? So the government's not going to print paper, right, to where they're going to borrow money, right, if they don't need to borrow money, right? They're not going to issue bonds. And yet I'm a pension manager that says I have to have a certain amount of my money in bonds from Europe, and Germany's the largest economy in Europe. Now I'm forced to buy. So when you have a limited supply and an ongoing demand, by definition, price goes up. And when price goes up on a bond, you have yield fall. That's just the way the mechanisms work. Again, I know it's very complex, but that's what happens.
If we're talking Econ 101, one of the questions...
We are way beyond Econ 101.
No, we're backing up here.
Okay.
Because here is a question we had. How do interest rates influence inflation?
Well, there's the theoretical part. And this is one of my big pet peeves, I guess, if you will. People want to rely on, especially as they get older. You know, when you have gray hair, people think you know more than when you were 30. Right. And I get that. I understand it. I've got a lot more experience than I did when I was 30. But just because I have gray hair doesn't make me wiser. Right. It just doesn't. But that's the way we tend to look at life. Well, we know the older you get, the more you tend to rely on rule of thumb as opposed to new data. And so you've got people who've gone through all of the economics and they've gone through all of this stuff and they tend to go back and say, well, history says if A occurs, then B has to be the result. And we don't live in a vacuum. We live in a world of massively changing demographics. We live in a world of massively changing economics. And there was never such a thing as qualitative easing. Germany has never had 30 years worth of negative bonds, right, in their arena. This is all brand new, right? So typically when you see interest rates go up, it's driven by a Federal Reserve who's trying to slow consumer spending. And that typically becomes because you're seeing the price of interest rates go higher. And so interest rates are typically artificially raised by the Federal Reserve in order to slow consumer spending, which slows inflation. That's classic economics 101. Right now, you didn't see a lot of it. It's because people aren't spending money. I doubled the size of your brokerage account. I'm not saying I did that, but let's just say that happened over the last 5 years. That doesn't mean at 52 that you're going out and buying more couches, more TVs, more washers and dryers. You already own those things. And that's where QE really failed. You cannot artificially increase demand just because you add more money. Demand is driven by true need, right? Until a price goes so low that I'll have a washer and dryer on every story of my house just because they're free, right? It just doesn't make sense. One last question.
Okay.
Pick wisely.
I will. This is kind. Well, I'm curious about this. I mean, are negative rates bad? Are they good?
I don't think we know the answer to that long term. The smart people will say this can't last forever. I don't think they know that either, right?
Okay.
I mean, I would agree that it probably can't last forever, but whether that's that forever is 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, or 10 years from now, that I can't address.
Do you think U.S. is kind of going in the trend with these?
I don't think we'll go negative unless something changes with our currency. But the yield, as we've seen in the 10-year Treasury, can certainly fall much quicker than people thought. Currently, as of the taping of the show, it's corrected a little bit upwards. But boy, did it have a fall down to the 1.4% level. You're listening to Consider This. Give Angie a call, 800-928-4001. So how does spending change after you retire? Are rules of thumb really rules that apply to you? Welcome to Consider This program. I'm your host, Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
And I'm Angie Kinzer.
Happy to have you all along. Seriously, I have spent 31 years of my life helping people figure out how quote-unquote retirement really works. So much to the point that we even renamed it to Your Life After Work. Here's what I have seen happen with more than 1,000 families that we've helped work themselves out of the workforce and into the quote-unquote Your Life After Work stage. The reality is how we spend money changes. How we spend when we first exit the workforce versus how we spend money later on. Angie's going to ask some of those questions, but we talk a lot about this in a workshop called Critical Tax Decisions That Will Impact Your Retirement. If you'd like to know more, you can give Angie a call at 800-928-4001. Angie, fire away.
Okay, we'll start with the most general question, and that is, can I expect spending to go down after retirement?
So you have two. What we try to teach people to do is to look at your unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
The way we write for the academia when I was at Purdue as an adjunct professor, we're writing about people who are at average income, average assets, or lower, and we're talking about a large number of people. The reality is you and your family are unique. You tend to have higher assets. You tend to have saved better and didn't necessarily spend everything that you had. That's why you're listening to the program, right? So what we do is help people in a financial, their retirement budget. I don't have a budget today. I will have one for retirement if I ever get to there, but break down into fixed expenses and social expenses. And Angie, what we find is fixed expenses too tend to go up with inflation. Ken, social expenses, however, tend to flatline between 65 and 68, and then they actually begin to decline. Your desire at 70 to go see the Grand Canyon or fly to Italy to go, it varies with people. But for the majority, I mean, we can watch distributions at age 68 just begin to fall off the cliff for social expenditures. People either can't get away from their grandkids, they can't get away from a doctor, or they just don't want to leave the comfy couch. And the older I get, the more I understand.
Well, I know that we've heard about what's called the 4% rule. And one thing I've learned from you and listening to you in the critical tax decisions lectures is you say a lot of it is based on assumptions. So
it's the bad news bears all over again. And it comes, Dr. Blitzer, who is the gentleman who takes care of the S&P 500 in terms of what company goes in and what companies go out. In the late 80s, early 90s, he said in a talk that he believed you could have 100% of your money in the S&P 500, take out 4% a year and never run out of money. And so a lot of people stick to that. One, you should never have 100% of your money in anything. It shouldn't be 100% cash, 100% bonds, 100% stocks. You know, so it may, academically, it may make sense, but how many of you would have survived 08 with leaving all of the money in? You know, at market highs, it would have worked out, but most people didn't have the tenacity to make that happen any more than they did in the tech wreck in 2000, the bad year of 2002, the crash in 87. People will move out on a bad time much sooner than they will move out in a good time. So you have to have the diversification. Secondly, it depends on the market valuation, whether the market is overvalued relative to the actual underlying assets or overvalued. So it changes all the time. In a properly diversified portfolio that is managed, we believe the number is closer to 3.8% right now. People will say that, well, 4%, 3.8, not that big of a difference. Run it out for 30 years, engineers. run it out for 30 years and compound it at a negative rate. 20 basis points is a lot more than you know. And by the way, that's net of fees and expenses. So the biggest driver, obviously, is taxes, which doesn't even show up in that number.
Okay, how do I calculate inflation or know when to increase my distributions?
You don't necessarily know, and I wouldn't rely on the government numbers. When you get CPI, the Consumer Price Index, that's what tells us when our Social Security goes up. Ken, you guys watch CPI because they tend to use that as part of the quotient for Fannie and Freddie in terms of where mortgage rates ought to be. Part of that goes into that play to a degree. Some would argue not at all. Some would argue a whole lot. It's probably somewhere in between. But the inflation rate is established by the government, but it's made up of two things. It's made up of goods and it's made up of services. So if you go to our conversation that we had earlier, right, in terms of how things go, in your experience, Angie, you just bought a new house, right? You're moving your stuff in.
Yes.
You're going out and buying some of those quote-unquote goods, right? Mm-hmm. Are washers and dryers cheaper today than they were 10 years ago or more expensive?
I don't know. I'm going to guess cheaper.
they're cheaper, and the technology's much, much
TVs
better.
I know TVs are cheaper.
TVs are 58% cheaper today than they were in 2010, and the technology is uncannily better. You know, I'm doing this DDPY yoga stuff, right, with Diamond Dallas Page. You know, and my son-in-law is over the other day and goes, you know, because I'm looking on my iPad, right? So here I am at 52. I'm hurting myself trying to do this workout, and I'm squinting. And, you know, Kale's looking at me going, Dad, you can put it on the big TV, you know. I'm going, what do you mean, right? And he moves a few buttons, and there's Diamond Dallas Page on my big TV, you know, and all of a sudden, woohoo, you know, I can now see the pain that I'm about to incur. Anyhow, I mean, the technology changes. So that's the goods. So one of the things you can expect at retirement time as you get older is the goods, one, you need less of them, but two, the price is declining, right? Now, some people would say, well, the trade deals are destroying that. No, they're not. They're still much cheaper. The trade deals may have increased some of them, but not near to the level as the other problem. And Ken, that's services, right? And I don't, you know, you may rush home and go and mow your yard. I would rather stay here and work and create more content and pay somebody else who wants to mow my yard. Right. You know, I'm good at this. I'm not so good at the other, right?
Gotcha.
The price that I pay to have my yard mowed today is a lot more money than the price that I paid 5 years ago. Right? A lot more money. So what you're seeing is the price of services go up, the price of goods go down. So for our younger millennial people who work at the Financial Enhancement Group, CPI is a beautiful thing because they're buying goods, not a whole lot of services, right? They're mowing their own yards, right? For people who are moving into retirement, you're not buying a lot of goods, you're buying a lot of services. And, you know, the beautician keeps charging more and more money to do my hair every year, right? I mean, it's just kind of like, you know, and I can't go to China for that. I can't, you know, I'm not flying to Vietnam for a haircut. I'm sorry, you know, it's just not going to work, right? Next question.
Well, in this article where we got this whole idea, it does list out some types of spending. And after retirement, it talks about housing and whether it goes up or down after you retire. It talks about usually by retirement, you've either downsized or have your mortgage paid off.
I have no idea where the word wives' tales ever came from.
Huh?
I don't know where that expression came from. Find that out for me because I want to know. Wives' tale. I'm sure it's something from back in the Shakespearean days. But here's the deal. That I'm going to downsize, thus my house is going to be worth less, is a wives' tale. I've seen a lot of people over 31 years move to smaller homes. That doesn't mean cheaper homes, right? And
what about having your mortgage paid off by then, though?
Well, they do that. They do have the mortgage paid off, but carry cost in having a mortgage is much greater than people know. Carry cost is what does something cost while I sleep? It's property taxes, it's utilities, it's cable, it's security. You know, it's the shoveling the snow if you live in Indiana. It's mowing the yard. It's taking care of the outside. Carry costs are a big deal and much more than your first house payment in my experience. Hey, you're listening to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark, your host, along with Ken Dilger and Angie Kinzer. Hey, if you want to do this on your own, that's your business. If you're looking for a fiduciary, that's our business. Give Angie a call, 800-928-4001.